You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Middleton High School students tackled issues of student activism and sexual assault in a podcast for a nationwide NPR challenge. We'll hear from two of those students about how it all went. Right now, it's time for our weekly state news roundup, where we check in with reporters around Wisconsin about the stories they've been covering. First, Governor Evers said this week that the state's plan to replace the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison with smaller regional facilities by 2021 might be unrealistic. One of those new facilities is slated to be built in the small town of Hortonia in Outagamie County, and residents there are pushing back against the plan. Mika Solner is a political and local reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Mika, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, what do we know about why Hortonia, a town of about 1,000 people, was chosen as a site for one of the new youth prisons to replace the troubled Lincoln Hills youth facility?
So Hortonia was chosen for a couple different reasons. One is that there's state-owned land there on the proposed site. And secondly, it was chosen because of its close proximity to inmates' homes and families. It sits right in the middle of Outagamie County, close to Appleton, not a far drive from Green Bay or Oshkosh either.
As I understand it, one of the concerns of the community that you write about was that nobody seemed to know this was coming. Is that right?
Right, and that was probably the biggest concern I've heard from local officials and residents, is that they felt kind of betrayed by the state. The town chairman found out through reading it in an article in a local newspaper. So locals say that they feel like they had no say in the state's decision.
What do we know about the facility, the size, the timeline, that kind of thing, the basics?
So we know that there's going to be about 36 inmates. It's going to be smaller than Lincoln Hills and both Copper Lake School for Girls. And so it's kind of on hold right now. We have to wait until funding is approved by the Joint Finance Committee. This week, we did see Republicans on the committee pull out that $80 million that was authorized for the new youth prisons. So this could delay closing Lincoln Hills, but we do know that the plan is to make it for families to visit inmates easier, so the state is looking for the solution to make them more modern, make them more like schools, less like prison facilities, to create this kind of new atmosphere for them.
Before we get into more local objections to this plan, you did write that at least one business leader was pointing out the possibility of more jobs coming along if this facility is built in Hortonia.
Right. So the proposed site sits right next to New London, and the mayor of New London is very much in favor of the proposed site. They think it could bring, you know, quite a few jobs into the area and actually increase that economic development. And they think that people can commute there and it will bring people to try their restaurants and maybe use their hotels and other things, like if the prison is actually built there.
Getting back to concerns from local residents, apart from the lack of early notification and input, what kind of concerns did you hear local residents raising?
So locals are also concerned about the safety and security of their community. They don't have a police presence in Hortonia, their own at least. They are also concerned about the halt of economic growth and development in that area. They think that prison will drive new businesses away from building there. And additionally, locals who do own homes are concerned about possibly their property values going down if they are sitting close by to a prison.
Is there any organized local opposition to the proposed facility?
Yeah, so there is a local grassroots movement that's been organized by some of the concerned locals who live in both New London and the Hortonia area. And their goal is to send a message to the state, kind of raising their opposition to the plan, and letting them know that they don't want this like near them and why they think that it is an inappropriate site for them to build the facility there.
Have you heard anything from lawmakers who represent the area?
We do know that there was a letter sent by several Republicans who, you know, are representing this region and beyond about, you know, how they oppose the site, how the process with how the state announced it was, they felt that that was wrong. Senator Cole has been particularly vocal in his opposition. And I believe that locals have been in contact with him too, to try and get him to, you know, create opposition to the state too.
Mika, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Mika Solner is a politics and local reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. We talked with her about how residents in Hortonia are reacting to the state's plan to build a new youth correctional facility in the town. Now, Governor Evers issued an executive order yesterday reestablishing Wisconsin's Pardon Review Board. He had promised to do that during last year's election campaign. Governor Scott Walker didn't issue pardons during his 8 years in office. Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, this new resumed state pardon board, what would this board do, Rich?
Well, they'll consider and make recommendations to the governor for inmates and people who have been released from prison but would like to remove felonies from their criminal records. So people like that have done their time but are having trouble getting jobs or certifications because of a felony, drug charge that they got when they were a teenager.
So this is not about commuting sentences currently being served, is that right?
That's right. Yeah, this is separate, but it is something that was quite common under former Republican and Democratic governors. Tommy Thompson back during his term, and Scott McCallum and Democratic Governor Doyle, they had pardoned hundreds of people. Hundreds.
Now we have this new board being created. What kind of people who's serving on this board now that it's going to exist again?
So there's nine members. The head of, and this is in the executive order, the head of the board will be the chief legal counsel for the governor. Currently, that is Ryan Nielsestuen, who is a former deputy secretary of the Department of Corrections. The other members are Jerry Hancock of the Prison Ministry Project, Nate Holton, who's works with the Milwaukee County Transit System but has also done things for the court, retired Judge Jeffrey Kramers, Wisconsin Deputy Secretary of the Department of Corrections, currently Cindy O'Donnell, and Nadia Perez Reyes of the State Department of Children and Families.
You also talked to a Republican state representative, Michael Schrah of Oshkosh, who had thoughts on the pardon board. What kind of things did you hear from him?
Well, his main concern was that this was created through executive order. He said he's not a big fan of those executive-type decisions, but he did say he's a fan of the pardon process, and he thinks that it should come back. He says he actually mentioned possibly reducing the prison population, and he specifically mentioned what are known as old law inmates. These are people who are serving prison sentences for crimes committed prior to 1999. That is when the state enacted what are called truth in sentencing laws, basically eliminating parole for people who convict crimes after that. But there are still more than 2,000 inmates currently serving in prisons who are eligible for parole but have not received them. So Schrah thinks that this could be one way to address that.
And Rich, do we have a sense of a timeline on when the pardon board could swing into action?
I wish I had that, Rob. That was one of the things that I was scrambling to try to find yesterday. It's not laid out in the executive order. It wasn't laid out in the press release from the governor's office. So we're still waiting on those details.
And Governor Evers had also run with the idea of trying to bring down the state's prison population. You mentioned a Republican representative talking about that a little bit as well. And this idea of people, as you said, who were imprisoned before the truth in sentencing law. Is there any indication here that that might be a next step after this initial pardon board gets going?
It's hard to say what the next step might be. I mean, I spoke with David Liners, who's the executive director for one of the top prison reform groups in Wisconsin known as Wisdom, based in Milwaukee. And he said that he expects the first, and it's speculation, but he expects the first pardons will have to do with people who are looking to get their records free of these felonies that might be stopping them from getting jobs or certifications. Then he said after that, they'll start to look at people who may have been over-sentenced in his terms during the tough-on-crime era of the early or late 1990s and early 2000s.
Rich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in Eau Claire, looking at Governor Evers' newly announced pardon board. Finally, a Boston-based company is auctioning off a set of designs for a home located on Wausau's Grand Avenue. Designs hand-drawn by famed Wisconsin architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Keith Ulig is a human interest reporter, a features reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. Keith, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. Well, tell us about these plans that went on the auction block.
Well, these plans, I don't think that they were drawn specifically by Frank Lloyd Wright, but they were drawn in his shop in Taliesin.
Ah.
And he also, he approved them. There is a, on the bottom of the plans, it's like one large sheet of paper from my under, from the description, and he in pencil initialed them. And he had a hand in designing this house. The house was owned by Dewey and Julia Wright. It's the same spelling, but no relation. And they went down to meet with him, probably in 1957 or 1956, and the house was built in 1958.
So people had the opportunity to bid on a set of plans under the auspices of Frank Lloyd Wright. It's got his initials on them. What ended up happening with the auction?
The auction, there were several bids. It went to $5,000, which I think to me and you, Rob, that seems like a lot of money for some architectural drawings. But that wasn't enough for the seller. And we don't know who the seller is. But it did not meet the reserve price. So I was told that our auction will put it on hold and put it up for a bid sometime in the future.
And Keith, as we wrap up, I understand a kitchen was one of the key designs here, a Frank Lloyd Wright-style kitchen design.
It's the kitchen itself, and there are a variety of perspectives of the kitchen, and it's like a sort of a semicircle, not quite the size of a semicircle, and it shows where the appliances would go, storage, a movable work table with a laminated maple top. Sounds nice. A little like a breakfast nook or a little nook with seats and stuff.
If money were no object, Keith, would you put this up on the wall for a good conversation starter?
You know what I would do? I would make a copy of it, and then I would recreate it. I'd use those plans to recreate the kitchen, put a wing off of my own house here in Wausau.
Fantastic. Keith, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Take care, Rob.
That's Keith Ulig, reporter with the Wausau Daily Herald. He told us about designs for a Wausau home by Frank Lloyd Wright's crew. Those designs were up for auction, might be up again. We wrapped up our weekly check there on stories from around the state. When NPR put out a call for students nationwide to submit podcasts about topics important to them, a group of Middleton High School juniors dug right into issues of student activism and sexual assault. Those were front and center at the school last fall when students protested over what they said was the school administration not doing enough to address complaints of sexual harassment and assault. Just days after that protest, a pair of students were charged with sexually assaulting a third student. In their podcast, this group of Middleton juniors critiques the student body for not speaking up as much after that development. To talk more about what they learned by creating the podcast, we brought in a couple of the students here to the studio earlier in the week, Lily McGuffey and Ella Roach. Lily, thanks for coming in.
Yeah.
And Ella, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Let's talk about podcasts in general before we get into your podcast in particular. Ella, are you a big podcast listener even before this project?
I listen to podcasts when I'm mowing the lawn, and that's about it.
Okay. You got to crank them up pretty loud.
Definitely.
And Lily, are you a podcast listener?
Not as much. I listen to podcasts like for interest, especially like for school things when I want to like know more and in depth.
And I understand creating this podcast was part of an assignment related to getting ready for an AP exam in English. But as it went on, Lily, did this turn into more than just a normal homework assignment for you?
Yeah, definitely. It was something we'd never done before. For us, it was like an ungraded assignment. So it was a lot of more personal. It felt really like deeply connected, and you were doing something more for just school and for something like deeper than school.
And Ella, a lot of people listening to podcasts might think, oh, that came together pretty easy, or listening to the radio for that matter. How much work went into this?
A lot of work went into this, especially since, like Lily said, it was a non-graded project, but we had an essay that went along with it. So we had to write an essay about the topic. So we spent a lot of time researching for the essay and writing that, and then we would transfer that all into a script for the podcast.
Lily, let's get into the topic of the podcast. You could have done any subject. You all tackled a pretty difficult and serious topic, student activism and sexual assault in your school. What led you and the group to decide to tackle that topic?
So when we were looking through like some of the NPR criteria, we saw that one of them was like personal connection. And so this protest that had happened had just happened maybe like not even a month ago. And there was other protests coming up. And so we thought it was a really important topic. And obviously everyone in our school, or not everyone, but most people have like dabbled in a little bit of social activism, whether it's a protest or something different. And so we knew it was something that like people could connect to, but also was something like personal.
I want to give a listen to a moment on that theme, actually. Here's a bit from the podcast.
What most determines whether or not people get involved in a cause is how much of a personal stake they have in it. But personal connection interferes with objectivity. It can actively change how people think about a case, leading to conscious or subconscious denial of the facts.
As we heard there, Ella, we just heard what Lily was talking about, that theme of how do our personal connections with people, our personal biases influence the way we decide to take action or not. This is something that keeps coming up in the podcast, right?
Definitely.
Why did that come up as such a theme, apart from NPR looking for it in their contest?
I think for us, especially as high school students, it's because a lot of the things that we protest about or take action on directly impacts us as students in our school community. Specifically with the sexual assault case, that affected students in our school. It affected our friends, our classmates, people we'd see in the halls. So it kept cropping up because we protest for issues that are directly impacting our lives.
Lily, did it make you, going through this process, make you start to question our motivations when we decide to take action, like a protest, for example?
Yeah, it definitely made me kind of look back on the protests I've been to and see where my like true values lied. And then when it came to protests in the future, remembering that protests are spreading awareness, but that I needed, in order to make a change, I needed to take action afterwards to actually make a change. And I think doing the podcast helped really change my own actions. And I think starting with yourself is like the best way to like spread to other people.
Doing this, Ella, in podcast form, did this lead you to maybe think about issues maybe in a different way than you would have if you wrote, say, a term paper on it?
I think it did, especially in the podcast, because we were working in groups. Mm-hmm. And a lot of discussion around activism sometimes relates to being in your own bubble and how sometimes you take action or you form certain beliefs based on your own echo chambers and what you feed yourself on social media and what news outlets you listen to, since a lot of them are polarized in today's age. So working with a group definitely changed some of my opinions, and it changed the project going forward.
Lily, as you mentioned, this was submitted for an NPR contest. Did that feel like it upped the stakes for you? This isn't just going to your teacher and your classmates. This is going to real professionals out there.
Yeah, I definitely think it upped the stakes, but also wanting to impress our teacher and do well. But definitely the contest felt like almost even more important than a grade, because it was something that's like, man, people might actually be listening to this, and we want it to matter, and we want it to like mean something.
All right, we've got the teacher on the other side of the glass. Did they impress you? We got a thumbs up on that, definitely. Ella, I don't want to, I mean, you're going into your senior years in high school now. I don't want to commit you to a career path now. But does doing a podcast like this make you think something involving media or audio or production or things like that?
I also write for our school newspaper at the high
school.
Okay, so
you're already there.
So, yeah, I'm kind of already there. So I'm looking at journalism as a career, and doing this podcast also made me reconsider politics as a career, because policy is a way to make change. And the more I've thought about it, the more I've realized that I don't have to stick with one career for my entire life, and I can use my experience as a journalist or whatever I choose to help shape my later career.
Lily, how about you? Did this make you think about what you want to pursue, say, in college or beyond?
I mean, not necessarily a career choice, but it made me realize that, like, especially when as I get older and I have more influence as things such as like a voter, that the things I do can really make a difference, and that maybe I have another job, but it's always important to keep activism like right front center so that you're making a change in that you're influencing the newer generations.
I want to give another listen now to part of your podcast. This, I think, is a recapping toward the end of it.
And while the Middleton protests we mentioned failed to create a long-lasting community of student activists, they're just two examples of student activism. Protests like this are needed in order to create a lasting change in our community. They help us learn from our mistakes and improve how we advocate in the future. And it starts with us.
Ella, the project is done. It's in the can, as we used to say. Nobody actually says that anymore. We don't use cans, for one thing. But you're done, but do you feel like there's stuff here, either themes in the story, in the podcast, that you'd want to pursue and maybe do another project in the future?
I think so. And I think one of the big themes that we found as we created this podcast was the difference between awareness and action. And we talked a lot about how these protests don't often result in a lot of tangible change, but they do spread awareness. They do get people to root for a cause, and that is still important. So the idea that we just have to reframe it and we have to help others reframe their thinking, that protests aren't the end goal. They're just the first step in a long journey.
Lily, you mentioned maybe having more political awareness now. We hear a lot about fewer people getting involved in politics, concerns about people not running for office. Do you think a project like this and maybe having more people do projects like this could help turn that around?
Yeah, I definitely think that if people realize, especially that young people like us care, it would influence people to do things like run for office, but also to influence people our age to learn that their actions do make a difference. And they may be one person, but when they influence others to do things, that it creates like a mass change. And that's how you really make social action become change.
We'll leave it there for now. Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
And Ella, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
That was Ella Roach and Lily McGuffey, students at Middleton High School. We talked to them about a podcast they helped put together looking at student activism and sexual assault for an NPR student podcast challenge. More women than ever are playing college sports these days. Well, when you look at who's coaching them, it's a different story. According to research from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport, the percentage of women coaching women at the collegiate level is close to an all-time low. Our next guest is here to look at why that is, the barriers that exist for current women coaches, and what can be done about it. Nicole Lavoie is a senior lecturer in the School of Kinesiology at the University of Minnesota, where she's also the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. Her recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled "The War on Women Coaches." Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, tell us how we got here to have this decline in the number and the percentage of women head coaches.
Yeah, most people assume that we're at a record high of women coaches, given the skyrocketing rate of participation in sport for girls and women. But in 1972, when Title IX was passed, which is a federal civil rights law making gender discrimination in the schools illegal, it opened the floodgates of participation opportunities for girls to play. Back then, it was about 1 in 27 girls played sports. Today, it's about 1 in 3. Now, back then, about 90% of girls were coached by women. And today, we're near an all-time low at around 42% of all collegiate women are coached by women. And the numbers are even more dire at the high school and youth levels.
Right. I saw that number, 42%. I thought, oh, that's pretty close to even, until I realized that's only considering women's sports in college. So more women are being coached by men than are being coached by women.
That is correct. And men are coached rarely by women. Around 2 to 4% of the time are men and boys being coached by women. So if you look at all the coaching jobs across of coaching girls and women and coaching boys and men, men hold around 75% of all head coaching jobs.
In that piece you mentioned at the website, The Conversation, you key in on one particular potential cause here, a double standard. The kind of behavior we might expect from a coach, we see a man do it, we say it's okay. We see a woman do it, we start to worry. What's going on?
Yeah, due to gender stereotypes and gender bias and sexism and homophobia, a lot of the things that we confront on a daily basis, we have expectations that women be nurturing, caring, and supportive and relationship-oriented. And when we think of men, we want them to be assertive and independent and dominant. And when men and women divert from these traditional stereotypical gender norms, they're critiqued. So what we know from the data is that what it means to be a coach privileges the behaviors that we associate with men and masculinity. coaches are expected to be confident and demanding and assertive. And when women need to be a coach and they act, in effect, like men, they are subject to backlash. And that is due to stereotypes and gender bias.
One interesting set of examples you cite in that piece is that for coaches fired for actual abusive behavior to their students, women and men face different outcomes when they get back into the job market. What did you see?
Yeah, there's been an alarming trend, not only that due to gender bias, women's behaviors are perceived and evaluated and interpreted very differently than their male colleagues. And we see that many women coaches are being fired or their contract renewed or they're being forced to resign due to allegations of athlete abuse. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't take accusations of abuse seriously, but when women are fired from their positions as coaches, they are much less likely. In fact, it is rarely possible that they enter back into the coaching carousel and find a comparable and equal position, as where their male colleagues will quickly get rehired and enter back into the coaching ranks.
Talking to Nicole Lavoy from the University of Minnesota School of Kinesiology, director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. The question, why are the numbers of women coaching in athletics, college and elsewhere, why is that number going down over time? Nicole, I understand you were a college athlete yourself and you were a collegiate coach yourself. What kind of things did you see in your own personal experience?
You know, when I was coaching in my 20s and early 30s, I think I was just young and naive enough not to really notice a lot of the bias that I was facing. But looking back, I certainly faced a lot of scrutiny, having to perform to be perceived as competent. My older male colleagues would often be patronizing or act very paternalistic, like they're my father, and pat me on the head and, you know, say, you're too young and pretty to coach, or, you know, things like that, that at the time you just sort of laugh off, but it gets under your skin. And now as a scholar and a gender scholar sport, I understand what I was experiencing as bias.
So assuming we want to turn these numbers around, what do you see as the starting point for trying to, I guess, bring more women into coaching and create an environment where they can stay there?
Yeah. You know, I get asked this question a lot, Rob, and I think that the strategies to move the needle up in the right direction are complicated. You know, if it were easy, the numbers would be growing rapidly, which they certainly aren't. They're very stagnant at around 42%. So I think systemically, societally, everyone really needs to do a better job of confronting their own bias, because we all have it, whether it's gender or racial bias. And then those biases seep into the hiring processes about who we recruit, how we recruit them, who we interview, and who we hire. And we know that people tend to hire people like themselves. And because most athletic directors in the U.S. are male, they tend to hire other men because that's who's in their network and that's who they're comfortable with. So I think, first of all, we need to confront bias in the system. Two, I'd say athletic directors and decision makers, people in power, need to create a culture where women feel valued, safe, and supported. Many women do not feel any of those things. And then I think we need to stop blaming women for the lack of women coaches. A lot of things that I hear when I'm out giving talks around the country is that, well, you know, women don't apply, there aren't enough women, women choose not to coach, et cetera, et cetera, without looking at these systemic barriers that impede women from entering into the ring in the first place. So there's so many things that we could do. We could probably talk an hour just on that, Rob. But those are some kind of top line thoughts I have.
I want to give a listen to the head coach of the Notre Dame women's basketball team. Pretty good program. They've had their definite successes. Muffet McGraw made headlines earlier this year when she said she would not hire another man for a coaching staff. It's been all female for the past, I think, 7 years. In a press conference, here's a part of what she had to say.
Girls are socialized to know when they come out, gender roles are already set. Men run the world. Men have the power. Men make the decisions. It's always the men that is the stronger one. And when these girls are coming out, who are they looking up to tell them that that's not the way it has to be? And where better to do that than in sports?
So providing the role models on her coaching staff in that case.
Yes. And that's really important, Rob, because we know from the data that when young women are coached by women, they're more likely to go into coaching. And we know that same-sex role models matter. They matter for boys and they matter for girls. So most boys, and I would say 100% of boys, get a male coaching role model. And many girls and women go through their entire sporting career never having had a female coaching role model. And we know that matters based on the data.
If you were talking to a young girl, high school or college level, thinking, hey, maybe coaching is for me, I don't know, what would you have to say to them?
The simplest thing that we can say to young girls who desire to coach is go for it. Encourage them. A lot of women and girls that get into coaching is simply because someone they admire, a significant other, a coach, a teacher, a parent, an aunt, an uncle, said, hey, you know, I think you'd be a good coach. I think you should do that. And if you want to, let's talk about it and I'll help you. Simply asking and inviting girls to think about coaching is the most powerful, simple, free, and easy strategy we can employ.
We're talking about the declining numbers of women coaches in college sports, as well as other levels of sport. Our guest is Nicole Lavoie of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see this firsthand, maybe, as a college or high school athlete? Do you think there's a difference in how male and female coaches are perceived and treated? What can be done to increase the number of women in coaching positions? Do you have a personal experience as a woman yourself who has been a coach or been coached by women or men? What did you see there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Nicole Lavoie of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about the challenges women face coaching at the collegiate level and why the number of women coaches has actually gone down over the decades. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your comments, your experiences, and your questions for our guest. If you have been a woman in coaching, we'd definitely like to hear from you, whatever level you coached at, from 5-year-olds up through college level and beyond. Did you feel like you were accepted as a coach, whether you're coaching boys or girls, men or women along the way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nicole, do you see authorities on these issues? People at the NCAA, for example, paying attention, caring about this as an issue?
Yes, I do. In fact, I work very closely with the NCAA Office of Inclusion and Dr. Amy Wilson and Catrice Albert, who fund and support many initiatives that I and my colleagues work on around increasing the percentage of women coaches and supporting and developing them.
Are they making a dent, though, when they do that?
Yes. In fact, we are. The numbers of women coaches is slowly creeping up. We see about 0.1 to 0.3%. Now, that's 0.1, not 1%. Of an increase every year. And that is a good thing because it's going up. And I feel that if we didn't put the energy in terms of research, education, and outreach between the Tucker Center and all our collaborative partners, that it definitely would be declining. So we know that when we do women-only or women-focused coaching education and development networking, it does make an impact.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Elise is with us in Madison. Elise, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Elise?
Hi. So I've done a fair amount of coaching, both at the middle school level, at the high school level, varsity assistant, things like that. I was a collegiate athlete myself, and I recently just stopped coaching for a lot of reasons, but one of it is I don't like how I'm treated by dads. I feel like a lot of times they don't value my knowledge. Even though I played softball in college, they will try to give me tips, or they'll mention like, oh, you will be such a good coach after you get some more experience, even though I have a lot of experience.
Elise, thanks so much. Do you think you would ever go back into coaching?
I hope so. I love it and I miss it, but it's too hard right now.
Elise, sorry about that. Thank you so much for sharing your story. That sounds, Nicole, like it's going to be something that was familiar to you as a coach.
Unfortunately, yes. I hear countless stories weekly, sometimes daily, of women like Elise who have stopped coaching because they're just tired of putting up with the discrimination and harassment and bias by sport parents, colleagues, referees, and other people in the sport environment. And it really breaks my heart because, Elise, if you're still listening, I hope you get back in because those girls need you, they value you, and you make a big impact in their lives. And I know it's hard, but it's so important that we see female role models in that space.
Do you have a message for the sports dads out there, Nicole, who it sounds like helped drive Elise out of coaching?
I do. You know, I don't want to paint the picture that all males or male coaches shouldn't be coaching girls at all. There are many wonderful male coaches. What I'm advocating for is to create a climate where we have more women succeeding, and that includes male allies. And we have many male allies. Not all men are trying to drive women out of coaching. That's just not true. So for the dads and the male allies listening out there, just know that your daughters desperately want and need female role models, and that due to your own gender bias, how you perceive and evaluate women coaches is very different from how you perceive male coaches, and you just got to give them a break, support them, and lift them up and champion them rather than criticize and tear them down. It's really simple.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Nicole Lavoie from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport, talking about a low number of women in coaching at the collegiate and other levels. Back to your calls now. Bryn is with us in North Freedom. Bryn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Bryn?
So essentially, I was wondering if the number of women coaches now versus, or percentage of women coaches now versus time before, was somehow due to the increased level of respect of the female athletes. So when female athletes in the past weren't seen as valuable players, that maybe men weren't interested in coaching them, maybe not worth the time, and now that society is advancing and appreciating women and all they're bringing to the table, that more men are willing to coach. So we may see the numbers shift, but because women are more valued. However, I also think that there is still the stigma and are the better coach. So they are now sought out more instead of the female coach, which would be just as good.
Bryn, thanks for the call. Nicole, what do you think?
Yeah, I hear this a lot, Bryn. Thanks for your call. We know that, you know, when the number of women's and girls' teams increased, predominantly those positions were filled by men because now those positions were paid. They were more prestigious and more powerful. I mean, to be a head college coach at the University of Minnesota, you can make a viable living being a coach. And so that lured a lot of men into the profession. The other thing I think that Bryn is talking about gets back to this idea of the gender bias is that, you know, when we think of who would be the best coach, that obviously privileges men and the characteristics of male coaches. So a lot of people, if we want to hire the best to be the best program, they'll gravitate towards men. And even female athletes, due to their own gender bias, will say that they want to be coached by men. And what they don't realize is they're perpetuating gender stereotypes and gender bias, too. So we have a handout on the Tucker Center website called So You Want a Male Coach. And it's all the ways that we can respond to these claims that female athletes want male coaches because it's layered in bias. And we need to teach people why that's a problem.
Thanks for that call. We're going out to Ellen with us in Duluth. Ellen, hi. Ellen, are you there?
Yeah, hi, I'm here.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about Ellen?
I'm calling to share my experience as a coach of a co-ed track team over the last few years in high school. And based on what your guess is just...
Oh, I think we lost Ellen. Ellen, your line's breaking up. Sorry. Thank you for calling in. She had coached a co-ed high school team. Sorry. I would love to hear more about her experiences. Nicole, something I thought earlier, you said coaches, people want to see male, stereotypically, I guess, male attributes like assertiveness and dominance, not stereotypically women, female characteristics like nurturing. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't a great coach be able to do a little of both?
Yes. Yes, Rob. That is precisely the point, is that we need to let go of these gender stereotypes and what it means to be a good coach. Being a good coach is that you're knowledgeable and you're confident. You care about your athletes as people and as holistic human beings. You help them develop and you provide a safe environment for them. And those characteristics, I think, are a blend of stereotypical masculine and feminine characteristics that both men and women need to exhibit.
Looking into the future, Nicole, do you see a time in our lifetimes where we have more of a balance of men and women in coaching?
I certainly hope so. That's why I do what I do and advocate and do research and education around this, because I know it matters and I know it's important. And I hope that we can start reaching some equity in the near future.
Nicole, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
That's Nicole Lavoie, senior lecturer in the School of Kinesiology at the University of Minnesota, where she's also the director of the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport. We've been talking about women in coaching. The numbers of women, the percentage of women coaches has declined over the years since the early 1970s at the collegiate level. Numbers not much better at other levels as well. Still time for you to share your story. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know your own experience as an athlete, a parent, or a coach yourself. Again, let us know. Tell us about it over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, from ISIS to white supremacist movements, extremists have used the internet and social media very often as effective recruiting tools. The author of a new book lays out a plan to defeat the threat of online extremism. He says it's going to take entrepreneurs at social media companies, researchers, governments, and more to turn the tide in the future. A political scientist tells us American politics and society have changed a lot, but that our political institutions aren't keeping up with those changes. She's from Wisconsin. She'll join the show to tell us why that is at the roots of what a lot of people see as a crisis of governance here in the United States. Plus, it's time to check in with Discover Magazine. We'll look at some of the most intriguing stories from the worlds of science and technology. That, and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up here on Central Time.